This is tape 4 of the interview with Mr. Roy Wilkins. Proceed.
Well,
all right, sir.
Well, I was talking about, I think, Mr. Lomax's assertion that the NAACP, so-called top leadership, was in control and dominated the organization, and that the ideas for such ideas as came out that were progressive and militant and all the other things that Mr. Lomax thinks are necessary, as they came from the people in spite of the crushing control from New York and the suppression. Well, of course, we got a big laugh out of that here. The truth of the matter is that our chapters have been beseeched by us to become active in various ways. I recall that in the 1960, at the time of the mistreatment of 393 NAACP young people in Orangeburg, South Carolina, where the police turned water hoses on them in 30-degree weather, before they had ever demonstrated or carried a sign or done anything, that we felt so indignant about it here, we called upon our chapters to hold demonstrations against variety stores in the North to protest the way in which the variety stores in the South were calling upon the police or using the federal, the state governments and city police to mistreat our young people. And we had to discipline a number of our chapters throughout the country who felt that this idea coming from New York, from the headquarters that Mr. Lomax calls conservative, were so radical that they would disregard our instructions and requests. We had to take disciplinary action against a number of chapters. We got a response from the overwhelming majority of them, but this seems to us to disprove the Lomax theory. Of course, as I say, I can't afford to spend too much time on Louis Lomax. I think he is a sort of a parasite on the civil rights movement as it has developed. And when the thing is all over, he will probably be the only one with a fat bank account.
Well, not the only one, perhaps.
No, maybe not the only one, but the only one who consciously accumulated it during this period. This is really not really a condemnation, I suppose. He is a writer and lecturer, and who can blame him for utilizing current events for the purposes of making money?
Don't blame me either.
Well, it's when Louis takes on the pontifical air that he becomes sort of... I think the other civil rights organizations have found him similarly at fault, if I recall correctly. I've talked to some of them, and they've expressed more or less the same feeling.
Do you remember in any detail Faulkner's Sound and the Fury?
No. No,
well, the question is based on a character in that book, and yeah, and some remarks about it by James Baldwin, his mother, so I thought we should have that there. There's one question I do want to ask you. We all know more or less what the white stereotypes of the Negro are, even though they are contradictory ones sometimes, frequently contradictory. What about the Negro stereotypes of a white man? How would you describe them? aside from White Devil, which is one of them.
Well, the White Devil is a Muslim thing.
It's a Muslim one, yes. I mean, yes. In general, I mean, take any shades in, in types of stereotypes.
I hadn't ever thought about it precisely in that way. Negroes, of course, profess to know about white people because of their association with them in various ways.
Strategic position to see them.
Yes, but it seems to me they suffer from the same weakness that white people suffer from in making their judgments. A white man who makes his judgments about the Negro race from his cook or his chauffeur or his yard man or the porter in his store is just as badly advised as the Negro who judges white people by her mistress, if she's a domestic servant, or by any other, his straw boss, if he's a laborer. You do know them, or if he's a waiter in a club or a hotel, he judges white people by the way they act at table or how they react to the payment of their bills or by the size of the tip they use, by the amount of liquor they drink or by how they act and so on and so forth. I don't know that either the white man or the Negro knows the other one from such contacts. But I would say that I think Negroes do regard some white people as pretty clearly defined, exploiters, friends, lukewarm friends, real helpers, real friends, and they've come to differentiate, even believe it or not, between Southern white people. There was a time when they lumped them all together. They don't anymore. They have their suspicions of Southern white people, but they are not inclined to damn everybody as they once were. I don't know that they have a stereotype. And I don't know about white people and their stereotypes. As you said correctly, they're contradictory.
Sometimes they're contradictory, sometimes held to the same person. Contradiction held to the same person.
What are you going to do? How do you explain, for example, a white man who has a Negro family that where the boy or the girl has gone away to school and made a very good record and so on and so forth, and the white man is as proud of that as he can be, knowing that particular family. Yet he will make sweeping generalizations about Negroes in general being no good, lazy, unable to learn. We don't want him in school. He applauds the fact that this girl or boy went to the University of Chicago or the University of Illinois or Harvard or Yale, where he went to school with white boys and girls and so forth and so on. I don't want Negroes to go to school with my children.
Contradiction.
It's absolutely a contradiction. What are you going to do with a white people in Laurel, Mississippi, who cheer Leontine Price at the Metropolitan Opera and say she's a Laurel girl, she's a Mississippi girl, and we knew our girls can do it, our girls, and so forth and so on, but who turn right around in Laurel and deny the opportunity to somebody who doesn't have a sponsor that Leontine Price had. Negroes recognize these contradictions, too, and they rather roll with the punches, you might say. I'm sorry to say, an increasing expression among some Negroes in this period of tension, general statements like, you know, white people are all alike, or, you know, you can't trust white people, or you know how white people are, or I'm not sure we can trust the white man, or do you believe you can trust him, which is the way, even the way of framing the question means that I don't believe so. This skepticism is growing out of their continued frustration over, say, the Civil Rights Bill, the desegregation bill, the unemployment problem, the discrimination in employment. Now, they get impatient when you, if you bring up the statistic that there aren't enough jobs to go around, even for the white people, that you have a shortage. If you have in this town, let's say, 400 bricklayers, but you only have work for 200 bricklayers, and yet Negroes want to either get in the bricklayers union or already in the union and want to get some of the work. So you say to them, well, the real problem is to increase the economy and create more jobs. And they say, yes, but meanwhile I starve.
And he does.
He does starve. He's right. He's very absolutely correct on this.
Now what is the answer to that?
I don't know what the answer is. I only know that we must, if we're going to starve, then all Negroes shouldn't starve and all white people eat. If we're going to starve, let us starve in proportion.
Ratio starve.
Ratio starve. Whatever comfort you can get from that, you know. But I mean, what the Negro is saying is that he doesn't want to be discriminated against in this. He is beating his head against this business of automation, reduction of opportunities for employment. And he knows that. But he also knows that he isn't getting the training in new skills that he should get, and he isn't getting a crack at the new jobs. For example, in the South, where the Negro and the white have both been displaced from the land by industry and by diversified farming, and they've both gone to the cities or gone to the towns where new industries have been established. The white boys and girls, or men and women, either have been able to get jobs in the new industry without training, or they've got on-the-job training, or they have been able to get training and then get a job. But the Negro has had the door slammed in his face, and he has had to go all the way up to Ohio and Pennsylvania and Illinois and Indiana and Michigan to try to hunt for a job. Without any skills, he's right off the land. He lands there. He becomes a welfare case. Or he's crowded into an already overcrowded apartment or overcrowded house. He becomes a health menace. He becomes all of these things. And he causes frowns and apprehension in the city councils of northern cities and the mayors and the departments of welfare. And then the southerners don't help the situation any by pointing a finger and say, see, we told you what he was. Now he's on your doorstep and you see. But what they don't say to themselves is, I made him like that. And I think this, Mr. Warren, is coming home. There are two things that are coming home and to the northern white people and that are working against the southerners, although the results may not be seen tomorrow morning. One of them is that the Negroes coming north in their great unprepared, untrained, uneducated state, with their lack of the sense of participation in 20th century political, civic, and urban community life because of the deprivations, they have driven home to the northerner. What a terrible job the southerner has done with the Negro for 100 years in giving him advantages and giving him access to the training that even rudimentary training he should have had.
Let's say that's true. It certainly is true. But the same thing has happened in the South to a large number of white people. Now, the ratio question, again, is there, a lack of ratio. But given the economy of, say, Mississippi, just the economy, let's leave the will out of it,
yes,
and goodwill out of it.
Yes.
You have a vast number of white people in exactly the same situation.
Yes.
Or Alabama, or Louisiana.
Yes. Yes. Or Florida.
Or Florida. Or
where
Florida.
You see, that's true. That's true. And this is a problem.
An endemic ignorance.
Yes. Well, this is a problem we contend is a problem which must be met by the combined wisdom and resources of the county, the state, and the nation. This is a problem of displaced persons in a changing economy. And if they are white, they are going to be have to look after them. All we're saying is that the white Mississippian or Alabamian or Georgian, as the case might be, or Tennessean, can some proportion of them can go to the new industries and get a job.
Some proportion can, yes.
That's right. And some of them can get work on the new farms that are now dairy farms instead of cotton farms. But the Negro gets none of that work except his traditional work of the menial cleanup man.
Well, I was not saying we have an Elysium in Mississippi.
No.
That's not the point.
No.
This is what I'm saying, merely one thing, or implying it, that the situation for the Negro is related to a general situation.
Oh, precisely. And we realize that. And I think most Negroes understand it. Those who understand economic changes, they know this. But what is happening is that the northern white man is being converted to the Negro's contention, hitherto made mostly by Negroes, that I have been mistreated in the South. The northerner has either looked the other way or has listened to the more rosy accounts of how well the Negroes are getting along and how well they're satisfied, and has always regarded the problem as being 1,000 or more miles away. Now it's on his doorstep.
He's on his doorstep up the island here, too.
That's right. That's right. It's his doorstep in Cape Cod. Now, that is going to have a reaction, but sooner or later, you know, what Roosevelt is supposed to have said to Winston Churchill at one time about they were on a trip together in Africa and went over or through a British protectorate or a British colony. And FDR is supposed to have said to Winston, Winston, when the hell are you going to give these people a chance to be themselves and stop treating them like colonies? And Winston is supposed to reply to FDR, when are you going to free the Mississippi Negroes? Well, the idea is that the northern white politicians and industrialists and responsible people are going to pretty soon say to the southerners over their gin and tonic and this, that, and the other, you didn't do so well by the Negroes because we got a lot of them up there that came up from your state and they just that and the other. We contend that's all to our side. We contend further that the other thing that's going to have a backlash is the northerners who are coming south into the civil rights movement and are being met with oppression and mistreatment, and ministers, the rabbis, the students. Hardly a place I go. 2 days ago, I spoke at a university in New Jersey. And three students were introduced to me there as alumni of the jails, one from Georgia and two from somewhere else. A year ago, I spoke in Cole College, deep in the heart of Iowa.
I've been there,
yes. And they had three alumni from jail in Mississippi. These kids come back, they spread the story to their families, their churches, their sororities, their campuses. And it's no longer Wilkins of the NAACP or Martin Luther King spinning a tale of horror and oppression. It's these kids coming back and saying, this is what a policeman did to me. This is what the judge said. This is what my fine was. This is what my crime was supposed to be. And this is a kind of indictment that I don't believe the South ought to let stand. I think the cooler heads there, the ones who understand what it's all about, ought to take charge from the ones who are perpetuating these sort of things.
There's been no leadership in the South, this whole matter, as far as I can make out. There's no leadership for anything except a hardcore segregationist.
Some has emerged, Mr. Warren. Some has emerged. We have noted that businessmen in a number of areas have said, now this we don't want. We can't afford to have this upheaval. It's bad for business. The Tuscaloosa businessmen, for example, told Governor Wallace. They pleaded with him. The Birmingham businessmen pleaded with Wallace to ease up on his University of Alabama stand. The Norfolk businessmen in Virginia years ago took charge. It seems funny now to say years ago, but it is some years. Took charge of school desegregation in Norfolk.
Durham, too.
In Durham, they did the same thing. In Dallas, the top businessmen got together. This was a kind of a control thing. But nevertheless, it illustrates that when top business or just business gets together, they can have an effect on the politicians. And the politicians, I maintain still, the politicians are the big obstacle to understanding and progress along racial lines in the South.
Let's say that that's true, and I believe it's true. I think this is the biggest single factor. Some of the Southern editors think so, too. They don't put it in their papers very often.
No.
But this is the overreaching technique. If you have five men running for nomination of the Democratic Party for governor in Mississippi, each one says, I hate niggers worse than the niggers. You do.
Yes.
In any struggle for power, overreaching, bigger the promise, has its role.
Yes.
Let's take that same principle and put it back in terms of the Negro movement, you see.
Yeah.
Any movement invites overreaching.
Yes.
Now, how dangerous, we know how dangerous it is in Mississippi. How dangerous is the same principle in its operation in Negro leadership in the movement?
You mean Negroes overreaching themselves,
out-promising. Out-promising each other, moving toward
the
escalator of demonstration,
the
escalator of promises, the escalator of illusions
and
delusions. Well, how much of this is operating now loosely used, the Negro movement,
yes,
you see?
I don't know.
You observe some of it?
Some of it, yes. But we are meeting now, some of us, every month or 6 weeks. Martin Luther King, James Farmer of CORE, Whitney Young of the Urban League, Jack Greenberg of the NAACP, Legal Defense and Educational Fund, myself, SNCC.
Yes.
We meet every month or 6 weeks regularly. We have been doing it since last February. And we exchange views and we don't agree on any coordinated program. Each man still pursuing his own organizations.
Yes.
But nevertheless, there is a general understanding of what we're about and a general respect for our...
Well, now, I shouldn't assume, just out offhand and outside, among the men you name, the organizations you name, the question of overreaching will be one of real significance. But that doesn't exhaust the great grabs for power of it that go on in the world.
That's true. It does not. But nevertheless,
those are highly organized, responsible.
They are.
Things.
They are. But what you are saying is that the Negroes, whether they're highly organized in big groups or whether they're on local bandwagon people, tend to overreach in trying to match the white overreach.
Yes.
Or to try to
various ways.
Or to try to to erect, to prove that I'm more resistant to the white domination.
Yes, so I can offer more, I can get more done by my method.
Yes.
By my more, the black Muslim is the most extreme case.
Yes, yes.
And the new line of Malcolm X is clearly a first rate example. But we have, there are other examples seem to be floating around.
Yes. Well, this I think is true, and I think the Negroes, when you have 18 million people,
sure,
you're going to have the whole spectrum is going to be
human.
There. That's right.
But this is always a human factor in any general movement. It's always a question of who controls whatever motive. And overreaching is a natural technique. But how dangerous is this? We all know it's human.
Yes.
It's always bound to happen.
Yes.
Now, how dangerous is this? What symptoms are there being out of control?
I think it's almost self-controlling. I think any irresponsible leader or core or movement which genuinely overreaches itself to the point that it demonstrably inflicts damage upon people or the cause quickly loses its influence. Now, the Negro is very sensitive, even in spite of his realization that he can't retreat just because he meets white criticism, because he knows that he's lost that fear.
Yeah.
You can't say we mustn't do this because the white folks won't like it. He's lost that a long time ago. But he is very quick to sense genuine obstacle, a genuine hurt to the movement. And he won't follow a method that produces a genuine hurt or a lasting hurt.
Do I understand this to imply that whether it is intellectually grasped or whether it's just sensed that a policy that does not lead to the possibility of a rapprochement or reconciliation is instinctively somewhere along the way rejected by
he rejects it at the point where it becomes obvious that it never will produce the results that he desires.
And his desire then is the reconciled society. Is that the idea?
Well, that's his desire. When you leave out the Malcolm X's, of course.
Yes, I mean, leaving that out.
But you see, the Negro, I must draw a line here. He is not going to abandon any such leader just because he has an unpopular or an unorthodox approach, or an approach that some white people say is dangerous.
Yes.
You see, he's not going to abandon on that account. He will abandon it only when it's demonstrated that such tactics will not get him nearer the goal. Now, he isn't bothered about whether it's unpopular at the moment.
I understand.
You see, because it may be that with persistence and with weakening resistance over there, that it will become popular day after tomorrow or next month.
Yes.
You see, and will achieve what he wants. But if it's demonstrated that it hurts him in such a way that it impairs his progress forward, so that he won't get to where he wants to go, then he's going to ditch it.
Forward to what is what we get at there.
Yes.
Forward to the what being, say, the reconciled society. Where
yes.
It's,
what we were talking about at the very beginning.
Yes.
The society in which there are no restrictions and barriers on his movements and achievements as a citizen. Now, he doesn't expect, mind you, that this movement will establish him in the bosom of white people, within their love and affection. That is not his objective. He would be glad to have it. All human beings want to be regarded with some kind of a degree of affection. They don't want to be outside. But that's not his objective. His objective is not to be interfered with and restricted on the basis of color in the exercise of his ordinary human rights and citizenship rights. Now, if in the process he collects affection and regard and esteem, well and good. But if he does not, he will await the day when he does, because it's human that sooner or later he will, in the degree that he warrants it, he will collect these things.
But there is a society of mixed ethnic origins, mixed bloods, and it's a massive one. It's close to 200 million people.
Yes.
So we have to live together. You recognize that?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we must live together. And what I have said in any number of my talks is that this so-called revolution, I prefer to call it an upheaval, an upsurge,
yes,
must be conducted resolutely and in a determined fashion, in an uncompromising fashion, but it must be conducted also in a fashion that recognizes that when it's all over, we have got to live here together in mutual respect. And if we conduct ourselves, or they conduct themselves so, that we cannot have mutual respect hereafter, then all is lost. We aren't going anywhere. We aren't going to an island in the Caribbean or back to Africa. We're going to live right here. And they aren't going anywhere. So let's not look at each other day after tomorrow or year after next with smoldering hatred in our eyes or contempt. But let's recognize, as we do with a good football match, and it's far more serious than a football match, but it's only the aftermath I'm talking about, with that kind of respect and sportsmanship that recognizes we had a contest, you won, or I lost some and you won some, and we go forward from here. But not that I kicked you in the teeth and I spat on you and called you a chimpanzee, the things that you can't forget, as if you really meant them. You're not using them as a tactic or as a device.
Well, this is the end of tape 4 with Mr. Roy Wilkins. I'm going to be merciful, not bully you anymore about
that. Maybe we can come back again.